Numbers, chapters 12 and 13. The seventh talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on March 24, 2018 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 7, Numbers 12 and 13, accompanies this talk.
We're in the book of Numbers. We'll be looking at chapters 12 and 13 today. We're in a section of Numbers that spans about 10 chapters, and one of the major themes in those 10 chapters is the question of authority. Who has authority to be leading the people of Israel? You remember that in Exodus, that was one of Moses' major concerns, was about his people, and they would not accept him as their leader. And God went at some length to persuade him that it would be all right and that he should go and be their leader. And we've seen along the way that there are several times when the people have questioned Moses' leadership, and that is going to continue. In fact, there will be more pointed incidents over the next few chapters. Before we get into chapter 12, there are a few things from the previous two chapters that I just want to remind you of and kind of highlight. One is that in the previous chapters, but also even we've seen elsewhere in Exodus and in Numbers, that Moses is not really power hungry. He's very willing to share his authority with others. He's not grasping after power, and yet that's what he's going to be accused of. If you'll recall, before they got to Mount Sinai, Jethro advised Moses to appoint some men to help him judge the people of Israel, to settle disputes, and he did so. So that's one instance of where he has shared power. We saw last week that he wanted his brother-in-law to be their guide and to help them find their way through the wilderness. So that's also power sharing that he's willing to, the power that he's willing to give out. And then in the last chapter, at God's urging, Moses appointed 70 men to help him direct the people, to share the burden of his leadership. And in this instance, God did something that demonstrated the sharing of power. That is, his spirit was poured out on these 70 that were selected to help Moses share his leadership. And apparently it was a visible sign. They prophesied, and it was something that was apparently obvious. But as you will recall, there were two of those 70. They were supposed to come to the tent of meeting in order to receive the Spirit, but there were two of them that didn't show up at the tent of meeting. It's not clear why that happened. It's just the text just doesn't indicate at all, but they were not there. But they received the Spirit, and they were going around prophesying. Joshua, who is Moses' right-hand man, he saw that as troubling. And he brought it to the attention of Moses, and he told Moses, shouldn't they be restrained? And Moses says, don't worry about it. It's the Spirit of God. And if they've got the Spirit of God, that's fine with me. So there's another instance where his right-hand man is concerned about power that's outside of his control, but Moses is not. The other thing that we need to keep in mind from the previous chapters is that the concern that was raised about not having meat. It says in verse 4 that this complaining was instigated by the rabble, is what my translation has, or riffraff. It's a Hebrew word with alliteration in it, so it could be riffraff might be a better translation. And then it says in the next phrase that the sons of Israel, they went along with it, they followed suit. So the riffraff is being distinguished from the sons of Israel. And who is the riffraff? The riffraff is apparently the foreigners. Remember in Egypt, in Exodus, when they came out of Egypt, there was a mixed multitude that came with them. Those are apparently non-Israelites that came with them. And apparently, that's the same group of people that's being referred to here as the riffraff. It was the riffraff that instigated the concerns about not having meat, and that caused God to send a plague on them, and people got sick. Okay, so those two facts are both going to become important in chapter 12. First 8 verses. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?" And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. I'll stop there. Let's do this first part. So Miriam and Aaron come to Moses with this concern, and it just says, they don't apparently don't voice this, but it says that it was because of the Cushite woman whom he had married. Now, if we put together the different clues that we've seen along the way, apparently the concern is that the reason that they had the plague could be blamed on the foreign element that's in their midst. And Moses is oblivious to the fact that this foreign element is a bad element in their midst because he's married to a foreigner. He has a Cushite wife. So he's oblivious to this problem. But Miriam and Aaron, they see it. Now, it would appear that Miriam is the driving force behind this. And there are three reasons why it would appear that way. One is, her name is listed first. It's Miriam and Aaron that come to Moses. The second reason is the verb, when it says, in my translation says, then Miriam and Aaron spoke. In the Hebrew, typically the verb comes first. And in this case, then it's, and spoke Miriam and Aaron. And the verb spoke has a feminine singular form. So Miriam is really the one doing the speaking here. The other reason that I think that Miriam is the major impetus behind this is because she's the only one that gets punished in the end. So for those reasons, I think Miriam is the instigator of this. But Aaron is involved. The thing that has caused this concern on the part of Miriam is she is seeing that the foreign element is a problem, and she doesn't think that Moses realizes that. She apparently goes to Aaron and expresses that concern and recruits Aaron to support her. But the part that Aaron seems to be latching onto, the thing that's really important to him, is this issue of Moses has too much power. It needs to be distributed because he is prone to making mistakes as a result of not having a clarity of vision that others have. And they say, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? We have record that Miriam prophesied. In Exodus 15:20, it refers to her as a prophetess. That was in the context of her doing the dance after they crossed through the Red Sea. And in her mind, that apparently makes her qualified, just as qualified to be leading Israel as Moses. Because Moses is speaking for God, but she has also spoken for God, so why not? Isn't she qualified? And Aaron seems to share this concern. This is the part where Aaron is apparently fully on board, that there are others who are qualified to do the leadership that Moses is providing, and he should share it with them. And if he were to do so, they would avoid some of the problems that might otherwise come. Now, there's a parenthetical statement here about Moses being very humble, and there are two or three times at Gutenberg where one of the readings was, I think, Numbers and Deuteronomy, and every time I led that discussion, someone would point out this parenthetical statement and say, if Moses wrote Numbers, he couldn't write that. I'll just talk about this just a little bit because it came up so often. If someone says that they are humble, this is the argument. If someone says they are humble, is this not bragging and therefore proof that he is not humble? I remember I don't even remember the name of the show, but there was a Western a cowboy show that came on when I was young. And there was this group of gunslingers, and they were going around and doing various things. But one of the key lines that it was used almost every week was one of them would talk about being the fastest gun in the West. And then he'd follow up by, no brag, just fact. There's something profound about that, actually, because what we think of as a brag is a statement that's somehow highlighting what I can do and therefore putting me above others. But if it's absent of that element of putting me above others, if it's just a fact, like I'm going bald, that's not bragging. it just is. I mean, anything like that is. It's if it doesn't come with that attitude of, and therefore I'm better. And I think that's probably what is here, is that I don't know if Moses wrote this parenthetical statement or not. He may very well not have written this. It may have been added at a later date. There are people that argue that, and I think that's possible. But it's not inconceivable to me that Moses did write it, because I think that what we see in Moses is the kind of character where he recognizes who he is and where he is, where that puts him in the hierarchy of beings. And he could say that he is truly humble. It's interesting that Moses does not defend himself against these charges. All we have is this parenthetical statement. And what it's saying about Moses is that Moses is not the kind of person that's grasping, that's trying to get what's his. He's not worried about that. The Hebrew word that's used here means to be devout and trusting, that he trusts God to take care of him such that he does not have to put a premium on putting himself forward. The Greek word that's used to translate this Hebrew word in the Septuagint is the word that Jesus uses in the Beatitudes, where Jesus says, blessed are the meek. Those are the ones who aren't grasping, the ones who aren't trying to get as much power, money, whatever, as they can. He's not that. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those that are not grasping, for they will inherit the earth. And it makes that a truly beautiful statement. And it says here, and the Lord heard it. And that has to have been, I mean, as you're reading through the text, that's ominous. You can tell something's going to happen. Miriam and Aaron were acting as though God, who searches the depths of our hearts, was not there to unmask what was actually happening. But he was, and he will. So he calls them all to the tent of meeting, all three of them. Aaron, Miriam, and Moses are all supposed to come there. That is the place designated for God to interact with man, to make himself known. He comes down in the pillar of cloud, and he calls Aaron and Miriam to himself. Let me read this section. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and to Miriam, "You three come out to the tent of meeting." So the three of them came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the doorway of the tent. And he called Aaron and Miriam. When they had both come forward, he said, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly and not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses?" So Moses comes down. All three of them are there. He calls Aaron and Miriam to himself, and then he speaks to them. And in this statement, he's saying, "Don't you realize that when I speak to prophets, I speak to them in visions and dreams. But Moses, I relate to Moses differently. I speak to him person to person, face to face." And the implication is, how is it that you could not see this? And why did you seek, therefore, to bring him down? How could you be so presumptuous? And they're putting themselves forward in a way that shows that they lack the kind of humility that Moses has. Verse 9, "So the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed. But when the cloud had withdrawn from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous, as white as snow. And Aaron turned toward Miriam. Behold, she was leprous. Then Aaron said to Moses, 'Oh, my Lord, I beg you, do not account this sin to us, in which we have acted foolishly and in which we have sinned. Oh, do not let her be like one dead whose flesh is half eaten away when she comes from his mother's womb.' And Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, 'Oh, God, heal her, I pray.' But the Lord said to Moses, 'If her father had but spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and afterward she may be received again.' So Miriam was shut up outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not move on until Miriam was received again." So God acts in judgment in this case. It says, "The anger of the Lord burned against them, and he left them." Milgram, one of the commentators he's a Jewish commentator that I consult, he says, "God's departure brings punishment in its wake. Also, God's departure from Miriam and Aaron suggests the cancellation of their prophetic gifts, a fact underscored by Aaron's plea to Moses to intercede, a basic prophetic function, implying that he, Aaron, no longer could." It's possible that Milgram is right here. I'm inclined not to think that he is right. I'm not inclined to think that the prophetic gift was necessarily taken away from them, but it's possible. It's possible. In any case, the cloud was lifted from the tent, and when it was lifted from the tent, Aaron is the one who notices Miriam is white as snow. Miriam is leprous. So Aaron then pleads his case. And interestingly, he doesn't plead his case to God. He pleads his case to Moses. He turns to the one that they have been accusing. Now, the one that they have been accusing needs to be there to intercede for him. It's also interesting that it's Aaron that's doing this, and we have no indication of how Miriam responds to it. Ashley says, Aaron intercedes with Moses, who in turn intercedes with Yahweh for Miriam's restoration. Here again, the irony is obvious. Aaron, who had wanted to be able to be like his brother in the latter's role as speaker for Yahweh, is forced to intercede with Moses, who intercedes with God. Thus, the theme of equality and the complaint over Moses' wife come together at this point. Yahweh is right. Moses is special. And Aaron's plea is, we have sinned, we have acted foolishly, and do not let her be like one dead whose flesh is half eaten away when she comes from his mother's womb. So Moses does intercede. Moses does appeal to God, and God does act. Milgram says, Moses' intercession has ironic implications. Only he whom Miriam and Aaron have wronged can help them. So he appeals to God, and it's not clear if anything happens immediately or not. God's response to Moses' appeal is, if her father spit on her, she would have to endure shame for at least 7 days. So send her out of the camp for 7 days. So clearly, whether he immediately heals her of leprosy or it's later, after the 7 days that she's healed, this has to be a punishment that is of some duration. It's not going to be immediately erased. So Miriam goes out of camp for 7 days, and the whole group of Israelites, they stay put for those 7 days. They don't march any further. So the whole nation is delayed from going to the promised land 1 week longer because of Miriam's sin. Verse 16, afterward, however, the people moved out from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. So they're moving from Hazeroth, apparently, we don't know where any of these locations are for sure, but Hazeroth is apparently not too far from Sinai, and Paran is much further north. So they move from Hazeroth to Paran. Paran is just south of the area that eventually became part of Israel. What follows then, as I'm sure almost all of you know, is another one of the great sins of the Israelites in the wilderness. The first one is with the golden calf, and then the other one is what's coming up. And we've seen how in the text we see this general tendency towards insubordination among the people of Israel. And this is going to be kind of the culmination of that from the people as a whole, act of subordination, insubordination. Verse 13, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes, every one a leader among them. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran at the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the sons of Israel. These then were their names, from the tribe of Reuben, Shammua, the son of Zachur, from the tribe of Simeon, Shaphat, the son of Hori, from the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, from the tribe of Issachar, Igal, the son of Joseph, from the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun, from the tribe of Benjamin, Palti, the son of Raphu, from the tribe of Zebulun, Gadiel, the son of Sodi, from the tribe of Joseph, from the tribe of Manasseh, Gadi, the son of Susi. From the tribe of Dan, Amiel, the son of Gamali. From the tribe of Asher, Sether, the son of Michael. From the tribe of Naphtali, Nabi, the son of Vophsi. From the tribe of Gad, Goel, the son of Machi. These are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land. But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Okay. According to the text here, it's God who decides to send these scouts out into the land. But according to Deuteronomy, it's a little bit more complicated than that. That is to say, the people of Israel decide that the wise thing to do here is to send spies into the land, to look over the land, and come back with a report. That is conveyed to Moses, who conveys that to God, and God says, that's a good idea, let's do it. I think that's interesting because there's one more example of that dynamic that's at play, that God has given the people of Israel quite a bit of latitude. They're doing a lot of their own planning and taking their own steps within what God has said, hopefully. And in this case, they decided to send scouts, and God agreed with that. So Moses picks leaders from each tribe, one to represent each of the 12 tribes, and those are the leaders, those are the people that are going to go in and scout out the land. Milgram points out that the word that is used here is not the word for a military scout. So he says, thus the men were not ordinary military scouts, but distinguished leaders from each tribe who were chosen to witness God's truth by verifying the virtues of his land. According to this tradition, then, the venture was more a test of faith than a military expedition. That's an interesting observation, but it does seem to have a military intelligence component to it, nevertheless. The names of each of the 12 leaders is listed here, and interestingly, these names don't show up in either of the other two listings of the leaders of Israel. It would appear then that what was selected were younger men, because of the assignment. Younger men were selected from each tribe who were highly respected in their tribes, but they are not the elder leaders that have been listed elsewhere in Numbers. One of these that is selected to go in is Caleb, and that is significant. We'll see how significant that is later. He represents Judah, but interestingly, it doesn't point it out here, but he was not a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is a foreigner. He was a Kenizzite, which is thought to be a branch of the Edomites. We don't know when Caleb joined in with the Israelites, whether he was in Egypt and came out with them, or whether he joined them while at Mount Sinai. It's just not clear. But he has, along the way, joined them and has been there long enough that he has a reputation within the tribe of Judah, and was elected to represent them. Caleb and his descendants later on are given the land in the Hebron area, that's the area from which David comes later. And that was the area that was so important to Abraham much earlier. David, in fact, marries into his line when he marries Abigail. Abigail was a descendant of Caleb. So Caleb is one of these scouts that is sent in. Another one that is of note here is Joshua. Hoshea is the way that he's listed in verse 8, but it says in verse 16, but Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Hoshea means he saved. Joshua means Yahweh saved. So Moses has taken that impersonal pronoun in the name, built into the name, and he has put in a proper noun in the place of that. So Joshua means Yahweh saved. And from now on, that's the name by which you see him referred in the rest of the Old Testament. So those are two of the scouts. The others are obscure. We don't know much about them. But there are 12 total that are sent to go in. Verse 17, when Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, he said to them, go up there into the Negev, then go up into the hill country and see what the land is like and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, and how is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? And how is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. So these men are sent out. In the instructions, there is very sparse geographical information. And it could be that at the time that they were sent out, they didn't know much about the geography of the land that they were supposed to go into. It just says, go up there into the Negev. The Negev is just the next semi-desert region just north of where they are. And then go up into the hill country. Just beyond the Negev, there's the hill country. But it doesn't say anything more particular than that. The information that they are supposed to gather, what is the land like? And I suspect that this is just overall, this is your assignment. Go in and find out what the land is like. And then it gets more specific as to what they're supposed to look for. And the specifics are, find out whether the people are strong or weak, few or many. So apparently there we're looking at army strength, military strength. Is the land good or bad? There they're supposed to assess the land as far as livability, and probably in particular, does it have the kinds of resources and agriculture that we need? The cities and the fortifications. How are the cities in which they live, and are they open camps with fortifications? So the question there is again a military one. How fortified is it? And is it in cities, or are these nomads? Assessment, is the land fat or lean? There it's the assessment of the land's agricultural productivity. Is it a productive land? Is it treed? I think that's really interesting. Does it have trees? And I'm sure wood was a very valuable resource, but another thing is they're coming out of the desert. Is it going to be like this? Are there going to be trees there? Is there water? Is there a variety of plant life there? And then in sum, is the land good? Is it well defended? And what is the geography? Those are the things that they're supposed to assess. They were not charged with determining whether it could be taken, whether it could be conquered. They were just supposed to get this other information. And then, in addition to that, they're supposed to bring back samples of the fruit that's there. And then it points out that this is the time of the first ripe grapes, which is nice because that puts it on the calendar. We're looking at late July or early August that they are parked on the outside of the promised land. Okay, so that's what they're charged with doing. Verse 21. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob at Labo Hamath. When they had gone up into the Negev, they came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and from there cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between two men with some of the pomegranates and the figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the sons of Israel cut down from there. I assume that these 12 split up, but it doesn't really say. It could be that they traveled as a group of 12 throughout the land. And it only tells us that they went through the wilderness of Zin, which is just the next area up from Paran. They went as far north as Rehob, which is at Labo Hamath, and that's apparently Dan, so that's to the north. That's just at the feet. Do mountain have feet, or do they have a foot? At the bottom of Mount Hermon. So they went as far north as the promised land that was given to them. And then it points out that they went to Hebron. And that's significant because that was the land that was the center of Abraham's travels. And that's where Abraham's buried, I think, there. Certainly his Rachel is buried there, near there. So that area is significant to them. And it points out that at Hebron, there are the descendants of Anak, and that's going to come in later in the description of what they found. They go to the valley of Eshcol, and it's named Eshcol because Eshcol means bunch, a cluster. And they found a cluster of grapes that is so heavy that it takes two people. They put the cluster on a pole, and it takes two men to carry that back. And they bring some pomegranates and some figs. So they're coming with some tangible evidence of its productivity, as they were instructed to do. When they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." So that's the initial report that is given. It is indeed a good land. And they're reporting this to the whole congregation, not just Moses and Aaron. And they come back and they say, it is indeed a really good land. It's flowing with milk and honey. And as I've mentioned before, this was suggested to me by this woman who is an expert in agriculture at the time of the Iron Age, the time of David. And she says that when it says it's flowing with milk and honey, the important thing here is the diversity. Milk comes from pasture land. Honey comes from forest land. So one thing that's being emphasized here is the diversity that is existent there. And then the flowing is talking about the abundance. So it is abundant with diverse agricultural goods that come from both pasture land and from forest. That's the good part. That's the good news. The bad news is the people that are there are really bad, and they're big. The people are strong. The city's large and fortified. There are the descendants of Anak that are there, and the descendants of Anak are giants. And it's populated by all these peoples, all these bad peoples, the Amalekites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites. So that's the report that they bring back. Verse 30. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim," the sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim, "and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." So the initial report obviously was received with, people were very concerned, and they're making a lot of noise. Caleb has to quiet them down before he can respond. And his response, he does not challenge any of the facts that they have listed. All he does is he makes the statement, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." That's all he says. He doesn't argue facts. He just says, "We should take it. We will take it." The other spies then, they come back, and now they're giving their genuine subjective response to seeing the land. There are a lot of subjective statements here that we find in the second part that were not part of the first of the official report that they gave at the beginning. And in this subjective response then, they say, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong." So it's a direct contradiction of what Caleb is saying. We can't take it. And to support that claim that they can't take it, they point out that the land devours its inhabitants. And I'm not sure what that means. And unfortunately, the commentators aren't sure what that means either. Milgram says this, he analyzes how this verb is used elsewhere, and his assessment is, "Thus this idiom can only mean that the nature of the land is such that it will perpetually keep its inhabitants at war, perhaps a reflection of the geopolitical position of Canaan as a land bridge whose city-states were either fighting each other or stemming invasion from Asia or Africa." That's possible, I just don't know. But it's not good. Whatever it is, it's not good. They all go on to say, "We became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." We're puny compared to them. They are huge. Okay, then next week we'll look at how the people respond to that. And spoiler alert, it's not good. Okay. There are just a couple of things I want to talk about in conclusion. This, as I mentioned before, this section of Numbers is dealing with insubordination. It's one incident of insubordination after another throughout this center section of Numbers. And so I want to look at each time, what are we learning about insubordination, and why is that highlighted here so much? And the key question seems to be, who has the authority to lead this people? And that's what they're struggling over, trying to clarify. Who is it that is supposed to lead this people? Now, I want to revisit what were Miriam and Aaron thinking when they came to Moses? Why is it that they challenge his authority? I think that there are two parts to it. First one is the one that Miriam has put her finger on. She thinks that one of the main causes of the problems that the people of Israel have had is the foreign element that's in their midst. And her thinking apparently is, if they were under control, if Moses had brought them under control, we wouldn't have had the problems that we have had. And Moses just can't see the problem. He's married to a foreigner. He can't see things objectively. And Miriam is thinking, I am just as much a prophet as he is. I have spoken for God. And so I am qualified to share that power. And if I were to share that power, I could help him where he has those blind spots. So then, to strengthen her case, she recruits Aaron to come and confront Moses. And it's not clear whether Aaron thought that the foreigners were a problem as Miriam does, but he does seem to think that it would be good if Moses shared power. The textual evidence disputes both of these claims. The foreign element was not the primary problem. If you think back to last week, the grumbling did apparently start with the riffraff. That is highlighted by the text. But there was an incident that happened at the beginning of chapter 11 in which they complained and God sent fire on the camp and it burned the outskirts of the camp. There's no indication of a foreign element being instigating that. The foreign element is only highlighted in the text with the next plague that comes along. When the spies report back, it's one of the foreigners that was faithful. It was the faithful one and came back with a positive report. Caleb was one who was able to keep things in perspective. And as we go on, we'll see other indications that the foreign element is not the problem. So that's the text with respect to one claim. With respect to the other, that Moses needs to share his power. God had established a hierarchical authority structure. And from God's perspective, not all who prophesy are equal with respect to power and authority. To be equal with respect to one thing does not make one equal in all respects. Moses is in a category all by himself. God set it up that way. God gave him a unique role. God communicates to him in a unique way. And this should have been apparent to both Miriam and Aaron. Miriam and Aaron probably thought their concerns were absolutely justified. I think that because we are all very good at self-justification. And that's unfortunate. We are so good at it that we can't see that we're doing it. They were seeing Moses as being power hungry, but nothing could be further from the truth. Moses was the least grasping of all men. He was willing to share power, and it's Miriam and Aaron that were indeed the grasping ones. The other thing I want to talk about just briefly is the report of the spies. I just think this is very interesting. The initial report that they come back with is factually accurate. Caleb doesn't challenge any of the facts that they list. What the spies had done was selected the facts that they wanted to highlight, and they presented them in such a way as to have a certain effect, a predetermined effect, that is, to scare the people of Israel out of wanting to go. And that becomes clear when they make their second statement, but because then they engage in very subjective statements and in hyperbole. There are other important facts that could have been presented, such as God promised us the land. God has been faithful to us. God has shown his love to us. Those are all facts that could have been included in the report. But those were not included. Facts do not add up to the truth. Facts are just data points. An infinite listing of facts does not result in truth. One can use facts to cast doubt on the truth, to undermine the truth. I will use an example that I have used often in talking about this kind of thing, but I use it because it works so well. When my parents first moved to Eugene, they got a house on a corner lot. We put in a new lawn in the front of the house. And the day after we had put in the lawn, we came outside and there were bicycle tire tracks right across the front yard. We had a pretty good idea who probably did it. I mean, there was a neighbor boy, and he was the likely suspect in any such happening. So my mom asked him, "Billy, did you ride your bike across?" She said, "Billy, do you know how these tire tracks got in our yard?" And he said, "Yes, it was my sister's bike." That illustrates so well this problem that the worst of lies can be absolutely factual. If you present them in just the right way, you can create an impression that is very far from the truth. That's why truth cannot be fact-checked. On the news, they put all this emphasis on fact-checking, and it's laughable. Truth, for a variety of reasons, truth can't be fact-checked. Truth is more subtle than just a list of facts. Truth is the story that knits the data points together into a coherent whole and accurately describes reality. It can't just be a list of facts. It has to be put together into a story, into an explanation, a description that's coherent, fits together. And ultimately, truth, when we're talking about truth, it is a story that knits together all of the data points and focuses on the relationship of human reality to God the Creator. And lies are anything that is calculated to subvert this accounting, whether those lies are factual or not. So in this sense, then, the spies lied. It may be factual, but the spies lied. And Caleb recognized that. He doesn't even argue the facts. He just tries to remind them of the narrative of truth. And as we'll see next week, the Israelites were resistant to embracing that true narrative, which has been their problem all along. Okay, we've got lots of time for questions, if you have questions.
I'm always interested in the way that God communicates to people. Mm-hmm. And in this passages, we have him talking about speaking in dreams and visions and dark sayings or something along those lines. And yet to Moses, he speaks mouth to mouth or something along those lines.
Right.
So I don't know, is there any implication there, or how are you thinking about that? Is there an implication that God speaks in dark sayings and visions because people are not righteous? Is that the implication, or is there some other reason that you're thinking that's behind the way that he communicates? Anyway, just a question.
Well, are you wondering, does he speak in dark sayings? Does he speak in visions and stuff to Miriam and Aaron because they are less righteous than Moses? Is that what you're...
He says that he speaks to prophets and right. Everybody. But I guess the thing that I noticed was that when he talks about Moses, he says because Moses is... I forget the word he uses, but he's faithful. I think that was the
word. Faithful, right.
So I was wondering whether the faithfulness of Moses was the reason or had any implication on why God spoke to him that way.
Okay.
Or was it just that God chose Moses to be the person that he spoke to mouth to mouth? I don't know.
I'm inclined to think that the latter is primarily what's in view here, that Moses has been given this special status before God in a number of respects. And it lays that out way back in Exodus, where it says, God says, I will speak to Moses, and then he will relay that to Aaron, who will speak to the people. So, and it says Moses will be as God to Aaron. So Moses has this really special status. Now, part of that is Moses is faithful above all in his household. I don't know about the cause and effect, which is the cause, how that's working out exactly. But the two go together. The two do go together. Moses has a unique status, and Moses is really faithful to God. And I think that is really important later on, because Moses is such a great picture in so many respects of Jesus later on. I think God has created Moses in this position to be a picture of something that's later going to come.
And it seems also, I mean, it would make sense that when God is going to sort of give them the law, that he would want to do that somewhat more clearly than in dreams and visions and things of that sort.
Yes, yes. However, the law isn't always crystal clear, even as it is.
I guess this is more of an observation, but, I mean, Moses was chosen early on when he was put in a basket and saved from the killings. Right. But he was also Miriam and Aaron's little brother.
Right.
And I think sibling rivalry, especially in a culture where the oldest son is the one who inherits everything, you know, this is, was surely, I mean, I think it must have been part of the thing. How can this little brother who was, and he was also raised as a prince, you know, I mean, they must have been jealous from the beginning.
That's very, I think that's highly likely. And then one of the commentators pointed out that in the scene just previously, the earlier chapter, the power is of prophecy is given out to the 70. The Spirit of God comes on them. Miriam and Aaron are not mentioned in that passage whatsoever. They don't play a part in that power being passed to them. They aren't mentioned as one of the 70 that gets the power, and that there could be, that may have flared up some of the latent jealousy that was there. I think that's highly likely. Anything else?
So as spies, wouldn't they try to be unseen and like sneak around? I mean, if two guys are carrying a big blob of grapes, they'd look pretty obvious. And then the people, wouldn't they sort of, since they're bigger and badder, would they have just more blended into the culture, you think?
I don't really know. But there would have been travelers, merchants, who are kind of passing through all the time. My guess is that they would have wanted to appear as though they were that kind of person. They're just floating through. They've just got their camels and caravan, and they're just moving through and moving back out. I would guess that that's what they would have wanted to look like. Now, how do they get all these grapes out? I don't really know, but they probably got those towards the end of their trip. I doubt if they wanted to carry those for the whole trip. They're gone for 40 days. If they're gone for 40 days, you don't want to pick those up on the first day. You want to pick those up on the 38th or 39th day or something like that. So you don't have to carry them all that time. So it's as they're leaving.
So if they were like travelers, they may have purchased them, right?
They could have.
Yeah.
Very well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was a little surprised when you said that the spies, one of their missions was, or objectives was to verify whether the land was good or bad. A couple other things you said. Because didn't God say the land was flowing with milk and honey mm-hmm. before? So God had said that.
Yep.
So is that any indication of faithlessness or the them not believing God's word? I mean, I would think the leaders would say, God has said the land is flowing with milk and honey, and go in and verify it.
Right.
But it seemed like there was some doubt on their part.
I don't think there's any doubt on Moses' part. Hmm. And he's the one giving the assignment, and it's given with God's authority. But I think the idea is, it is a good land, go see in what way it is good. I suspect that's essentially what Moses is saying. And Moses says, bring back produce so we can see. I think his perspective is, once we know what we're going into, the people should be more motivated to go.
But it's just that statement where they said, see if the land is good or bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, wouldn't you think, it's like you said, wouldn't they say, go in and see it? We know it's good, find out where it's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's Moses' intent. Mm-hmm. I suspect in Moses' mind, what he's asking them to do is go and see in what way it's good and in what way it may be not perfect.
Okay.
But I don't think there's any question in his mind as to what they'll find there. Anything else?
When it talks about Miriam and Aaron speaking against Moses, do you think this is something were they making accusations to him to his face, or something that that they were talking to each other about in private?
Well, I think they talked to each other in private first, and then they go together to confront Moses.
And is it the confrontation, the one that God hears, or that it describes God hearing?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, he heard the rest too, but yeah. Okay. Thanks.